In fact, wasn't until the 21st of July, 44, that we went to France. And the thing I remember best about this was whether we were going to land dry-shod or wet-shod. In other words, we waterproofed the tanks, we de-waterproofed them, we waterproofed them again, and eventually we de-waterproofed them. And that kept us very busy.
I'll bet. Did you hear about some of the Sherbrooke Regiment, tank regiment,
yes,
where they had the floaters?
Yes, the DDs. The duplex drive tanks, they were called DDs, yeah.
And they had the floating apparatus,
yes,
and how some of them got dumped in 20 feet of water and didn't float.
That's
so
right.
Well.
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear this stuff then?
Oh, yes. It used to come back. In fact, we got intelligence summaries, which we, you know, how the battle was going and what was happening to our...
Now, would you lose anyone from your regiment to replace these...
No, because... we can go on to that, this particular thing. There's a tank delivery regiment was part of the order of battle, and this is what happened to me, because I was supernumerary to my regimental requirements. When they went to France on the 21st of July, we went the same day, but we went in a tank delivery squadron, and I was the senior British Columbia officer in the tank delivery squad, and I had a squadron's worth of replacement tanks with trained crews in them. And of course, we moved in right behind the regiment and established ourselves behind the regiment. And within the tank delivery regiment, there was a squadron that was meant to reinforce the British Columbia regiment, one for the Grenadiers, one for the Foot Guards. And we were grouped together. I remember living in an apple orchard just south of Echinabay in France, waiting, not very long, I might say, waiting until we were called forward to the regiment.
I'm thinking now, okay, when you went now, would you be stationed in southern England as well?
We were moved from our barracks to the Ashdown Forest near Crowborough in Kent. And that's where we were camouflaged in the Ashdown Forest. And extremely good job of camouflage, too. I had spent quite a bit of time when I was a machine gunner learning camouflage, and as a consequence I got jailed for an awful lot of the camouflage work in the regiment because I was supernumerary, and we camouflaged the whole regiment in the Ashdown Forest, plus the delivery tanks. And I remember going up in a Lysander aircraft and looking down on them every so often. To make sure that they were properly camouflaged. That was one of my jobs. Interesting job.
How do you camouflage a tank?
Well, when you've got heavy forest area like that, it wasn't too difficult. Your biggest problem was to make sure that the tracks going in and coming out of the forest were properly covered. And also by judicious use of scrim and camouflage nets and so forth to blend in with the foliage, you could do it.
So the tanks would be a green, forest green anyway, almost.
Yeah, they were. Green, gray color.
Mm-hmm. You prepare to go overseas. The D-Day landing is a success.
Mm-hmm.
I gather everyone is quite thrilled and happy.
Yes, and when we decided that we were going to go in dry shod, in other words, that we didn't have to have them all gucked up with the waterproofing material. We then knew that the landing had been a success because we were going, by this time the Mulberries had been established.
Yeah.
Not that we went in on the Mulberries, we went on in on things called rhinos, rhinoceroses.
Yeah.
And they were, we went from a tank landing ship and they hoisted their tanks up onto the rhinos, and we went in on the rhinos and they dropped their ramp in the front and we got in.
Drove off
right on the beach.
Oh,
great joke about that. Dear, dear friend of mine by the name of Bob Smith, who was our reconnaissance troop commander, he had come overseas much later than I did. And I always used to say to him, "Did you bring the mail, Smith?" You see, this was our little joke. So he landed on the rhino just in front of me in France. And he was standing on the beach when my rhino touched down. He said, yelled at me, "Hey, Kelly, did you bring the mail?" Got his own back after riding him for 3 years.
What about that waterproofing? It sounds a little screwy maybe right now, but I'm thinking of what was the procedure? Do you recall the procedures for waterproofing tanks?
Oh, it's a bituminous compound of some sort to cover all the places where water might come in, and the idea of making sure that the gun ports and so forth were all sealed. And of course, there was an X number of feet wade, another, you know, 4 foot wade and 6 foot wade and so forth, depending on how far you would have to go in, depending on how much the material you had to put on it. But as I say, it was a dirty job, but not that difficult. It kept us busy.
It gave you something to do.
Exactly.
That's great. Okay, now, July, you're waiting. Did the days drag on as you were waiting?
Well, actually, there was so much activity in southern England during that time. And then we started our move towards Tilbury Docks in, mid-July, we staged on the way down, got aboard our
Air Force now.
Yes, we are. If a bomb drops, it's not Skyland. Anyway, we got down there, so we were loaded aboard. And then when we landed in France, all the chaps that were in this tank delivery regiment, we took our squadrons into a bivouac area south of the battle, or at least behind the battle line, and we waited until our regiment called us up. And of course, that was the 21st of July, and on the 9th, 10th of July, I think the 8th was the first day, I got my first call for reinforcement. Somebody had been injured by shelling, wounded, and I had to send one complete tank crew up from my holdings in the unit, and they went forward. Sad to relate, they were all killed the next day, by the way, in a battle. I remember that first crew very well. And then the regiment got into the tremendous fight on the battle for the heights around Falaise, originally on the 8th and 9th of August, the St. Hugh Hill 195, and the next morning, the morning of the 11th of August, we all left the unit, the tank delivery regiment, because every tank I had was needed. And I was needed because we'd lost a few captains. We lost the colonel, we lost two majors and a few captains in that first initial battle they were in. And as a consequence, we then joined the regiment, all of us who were in the tank delivery regiment.
So, what squadron, place did you...
I became the second in command of A squadron, or the battle captain, really, of A squadron. Well, we had one captain. We didn't have enough people to go around at that time, so I was both. And I first got into action then on the 13th of August, 2 days after I reached the regiment. We got involved in Exercise Tallulah, or Operation Tallulah, which was later called Exercise Tractable. We used to call it the musical ride. That's what we called it amongst the, where we lined up sponson to sponson and charged up the St. Sylvain defile with the idea of capturing roofs on the Liège River. And that was my first major battle. And the Liège River, the whole battle of the St. Sylvain Gap. I must say that my first day in battle was confusing. We had been subjected to a lot of shelling from the, about the 10th of August on, so the troops had been blooded a bit, but you didn't know who was bloodying you, of course, when the long-range artillery was sniping at you, but this was the first day you were face-to-face with the enemy, and I thought the troops reacted quite favorably, especially knowing that the regiment had been practically wiped out 2 to 3 days before, and didn't seem to have any adverse effect. Morale was good, but it was confusing. One of the things that I think military historians should dwell on is that battle is confusing enough without imposing super confusion on it by changing the start line about a few minutes before the attack, changing the axis of advance and so forth. High-level planning by the time it filters down through the various battle procedures until it gets to the trooper in the lead tank, it's like a stately pavan, the way this thing takes place, you know, everybody going down, briefing below. In that particular battle in the St. Sylvan Defile on the 14th of August, we got a change in start line about 5 minutes before we were supposed to attack. And as a consequence, we were, it was like the Balaclava Melee. They were crossing around one another. And when we took off across the start line, we took a tremendous number of casualties, which I think could have been avoided if there had been a better method of A, sticking to a plan. A bad plan properly executed is much better than a brilliant plan diddled up. And as a consequence, we, on the 14th of August, we weren't that successful. I ended up the day with not only 8 tanks from my own squadron, but tanks from not only other regiments in the brigade, but some people from the tank brigade. And I formed a little squadron of my own. We re-netted and changed so forth, changed frequency so we could all talk to one another, holding a piece of high ground up on the top of the gap. Rather interesting to see that this could take place. I think the student of military history should look very closely at...
Who did you blame for that?
Don't blame anybody. No. You don't blame anybody. Well,
come on
you,
now.
Well, you realize...
There's got to be somebody to blame.
Well, you realize that George Kitching was relieved of his command immediately after that particular battle.
General Kitching, yes.
And I think that Stacy says it very well. Could we shut that off?
We're
on top.
We're back on. You were saying that, Stacy summed it up very well concerning General Kitching being relieved of command.
Well, he had no opportunity at all to take the division on a large exercise, a major exercise, before he took it in. And I don't know how well trained his staff was or anything of that nature, but the point is that...
It was a bum deal on for Kitching.
I think so. A very charming and talented man, and I certainly wouldn't like to say anything else other than the fact that I think Stacy's got it right.
So... Stacy in his book, The Victory Campaign, I assume, covers the situation, as far as you're concerned, right on the money.
Mm-hmm.
And that General Kitching, in essence, got the bum's rush concerning this disastrous...
Well, it was a series of disasters starting from the time the division first got into action until the fall of Falaise, really.
I was wondering, General Kitching lives in town. Have you ever talked to him about this?
No, we talked personally, and he's a great friend of mine, and I love him like a brother, but we never talked about that.
Okay, fair enough, sir. Now, as a soldier, though, now thinking now, because you know the man and all these other things, though, was it blamed, would it be blamed on the colonels, or would it be blamed on division, would it be blamed at Army?
They couldn't blame it on our colonel, he got killed.
No, okay. What I guess I'm getting at is that as a bunch of young men, I can see myself saying, if something goes wrong, I say, well, I jerk over there. It's easy to put blame on people as a young man, I guess is what I'm getting at. And here you are in the thick of things. Things aren't going properly. Things are being changed. Senior officers are changing things. And
I think your only reaction is, what the hell are those people doing? And they... The antecedent of they is never clear in your mind. What are they doing?
Okay. Anybody above major, eh?
anybody above you?
anybody above you? Well, that's what I was getting at. You're a captain.
However, you, when you examine your conscience, you say, if it was a debacle, you must have been part of it.
Yes. Now, during this first engagement, I guess we can continue on with that. Now, you were brought up. This is the thing. You become the battle captain. Who was your major?
At that time, Austin McBride, the chap that who had been with me in the Royal Montreal Regiment, the 32nd Recce, and the fellow who'd gone out to North Africa came back. And
so home, for as far as you were concerned.
Yes, so he came up at the same time as I did. He came from a reinforcement unit back in England, from the CACRU, the Canadian Armored Corps Reinforcement Unit. He came forward to take over one of the squadrons after the severe casualties that had been suffered on the 8th, 9th of August. So I just joined in behind my old boss again.
Okay. Your actual tasks as a battle captain, recall?
It depended entirely on how the squadron was being fought. If it was fought as a whole squadron, you were in the tank immediately behind the squadron commander and you conformed to his movements and did exactly as he told you. But if the squadron was being fought in half squadrons, as it frequently was, or two troops being attached to work with the infantry in an infantry come tank attack, then you would be in charge of that packet of two troops of tanks.
This type of thing. On your first day, though, as you say, they changed the start line on you.
I didn't see my squadron commander from the time we crossed the start line until about 5 o'clock in the morning of the next day, on the 15th of August.
And it was just what, ragtag blasting away? Or
yes, exactly. It was as I said, we juniors used to call it the musical ride because that's what it was, a charge of the Light Brigade up the St. Sylvan Gap, lost a lot of tanks, but there was a tremendous amount of heroism shown by a lot of Canadian soldiers, both on foot and on the kind of thing that happens in the confusion of battle is when we got to the town of Rouves, and we had some very bad fighting to get up on the banks of the Liège River, and we found a crossing of the river. A fellow by the name of Sam Bass, one of my sergeants, was instrumental in finding a ford across the river where we could take tanks, and we got our tanks across, and we got, I think, 8 tanks across the river, and had a couple of minor battles, skirmishes doing this, and then we saw the town of Rouves, and we thought we would fire into Rouves because it was one of our objectives. And I remember a chap coming up in the back of my tank, a major of infantry, I think from the Regina Johns, getting up in the back of my tank, and I said, "Hi, Major, is there anything I can do to help you?" And he said, "Yes, you could stop shelling that town. My troops have been in it for the last 15 minutes, you know?" This sort of confusion.
Be a little choked up? Or?
No, very decent chap.
No, were you?
Oh, yes, indeed, I was. We didn't inflict any casualties on the town, but and then then I lent him some tanks to help him with the clearing of the...
You had that authority to...
I was on my own. I was out of communication with...
you had the Mark 19 radio with all the frequencies.
Yep.
You couldn't keep up communication once it started?
No. In the early stages of the battle, by this time we were widely separated from
it. So just a charge.
A charge, that's right. And it proved successful in the long run, but we lost a lot of men doing it.
And a division commander as well, Kitching.
I don't know the background of that
okay.
at all,
okay.
Why he went, but I do know he was relieved after that.
When you formed up after your chart, I was thinking of intelligence now, you'd be fairly high up. Now, did you know who you were going to run into?
Oh, yes. You see, this is the trouble. I was talking about this, the battle procedure, you know, getting people briefed from army down to division down to brigade down to regiment to squadron to troop, and troop down to the leading tanks, the guys that are really going to fight the battle. I spoke of it earlier as being a stately pavane, but this doesn't really work. You've got to have some means of making sure the people up front know the immediate situation. But prior to that particular battle, we had air photos of the dispositions of the German troops on the ground. We knew who we were fighting to a certain degree anyway. They had identification because prisoners had been taken. We knew what divisions we were fighting against. I think it was the Panzer Grenadiers were our immediate opponents. And all this sort of thing just piles up as intelligence, and therefore you brief as much as you can to the people who are in the
front.
Did
you have an intelligence officer with the headquarters company?
In the headquarters squadron.
Squadron, yes. Sorry, squadron. Headquarters squadron, you'd have an intelligence officer. When you finished up after this day, now you didn't run into any German tanks, is that correct?
We ran into quite a few German tanks, and we lost people to German tanks, and we inflicted a few casualties. I don't know how many kills, and of course we were getting support from the Typhoons up above, and we were getting lots of artillery support, and we were always, we had a Fu with us. I remember the Fu very well. The forward observation officer from the artillery was with us when I ended up with my group, and he called down fire, and very effective fire. And by this time, of course, you see, what you've got to remember is that whole area around Falaise and the Gap was textbook country for the German army. They knew it inside out, and they fought beautiful defensive warfare in that particular piece of ground. It was new to us. We had maps, and we studied all the contours of the ground, and we knew generally where the enemy positions were. But we didn't know the ground intimately like the Germans did, and they were masters at the fighting withdrawal. This happened time and time again. I'm dwelling on this first battle because it's the one that sticks out most in your mind. The first time you knew that somebody was out to kill you, Jim Tedley, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This is the first time, the first experience that you had of that. And therefore, it sticks in your mind. But later on, the same thing happened. You would bounce into a strongly defended locality, usually about the last hours of the day. And by the time you got set to mount an attack on them, you would be attacking nothing. They would have fighting withdrawal. And that happened time and time again.
So you had very high estimation of your opponents.
Oh yes, that was an extremely well conducted campaign as far as the Germans were concerned.
Was there any doubt that you were maybe thrown back, or was...
I think the first big doubts we had were at the time of the Ardennes offensive. At that particular time, we were gung-ho still, you know, and a little nervous, but I can tell you...
You win out of your sails then, eh? Okay. This first one, going back to the first...
We should write a paper sometime on the difference between bravery and courage. It's a very different thing.
And what's your definition?
Oh, well, courage is somebody who has cancer, who knows he's going to die and starts to live a good life and, you know, prepares for death and so forth. Bravery is when you're showing off in front of the troops. You haven't got guts enough to be scared.
Were you afraid at all in your first...
Scared skinny.
Scared skinny, okay.
Couldn't show it, though. Wouldn't show.
And I gather everyone else there was as well.
Great. Some of the boys were great. I could tell
you. Was there any
little anecdote, you know?
Okay.
One of my troop commanders, a fellow named Warren Leeds from Montreal, nice, nice fellow. And this was his first experience. And he said, when I gradually got my bodies collected in a place where I could have a little O group down in an indentation, I called back all the officers. He said, "What are we going to do next? Tell them what I thought we should do next." Arnold said, I said, "Are you nervous?" And he said, "No, not at all." He said, "These German guns are no good." He said, "I've been hit a couple of times today," and he said, "they things don't explode." He said, "Come and have a look at my tank." So when we finished the ogre, went and looked at the tank. He had been struck twice by armored piercing shells, but a glancing blow off the sponson. And he thought that they were explosive shells and they were duds. I didn't tell him any different. I didn't want to discourage his gung-ho attitude towards the war.
Oh, was there any nutcases in the sense that, as you said, guys that were too dumb to be scared, or?
No, I haven't found that. I've found people who exhibited great personal bravery in action. Brigadier General Ned Ailey, a man you should interview sometime, is a consummate tank commander and brave as a lion. Rad Walters, another one amongst the seniors, that very brave. Bob Monsell, who retires as a lieutenant general, very cool in action. That's in 4 Brigade. It was after we got experienced and bloodied and so forth, and Monsell used to run the greatest O groups, operation groups, you know, telling us what we were going to do, and gave us time, and it was like a staff college exercise, and we became quite successful as a result of that. He would give part of the orders. His intelligence officer would give us the intelligence, you know, the AQ would give us the administrative paragraphs and so forth. You left the O groups under Moncel's command thinking, damn it, we're going to win this battle, there's no doubt about it. The confidence exuded by your commander and his staff.
Not with a turn go down the line, is that correct?
Oh, right down the line. You could tell it from changing corps commanders. For instance, when we were in fighting under 30 Corps under Sir Brian Horrocks, your morale used to go booming because Sir Brian was the personality. Everybody loved him. You knew that he wasn't going to throw you into battle uselessly or needlessly. You'd switch from corps to corps, as we frequently did, but I always remember the morale really booming when Sir Brian was at the helm.
Okay, let's get this first one again. The date on the first one for you would be...
Well, that would be, as I said, Operation Tallulah, which was called Tractable later on. It started on the 13th, 14th August in that area, and that was the one of the...
Just the fanatical charge, could you call it?
No, not fanatical charge. There was, as I say,
the musical drive.
A musical ride, that's what it was. And by the morning of the 15th, 16th, we were, formed up again, and we got back into our own squadron packets and ready to
kick off. Well, what happened after that? I guess what I'm getting at is that you got your objective, you supported the Regina Rifles.
Mm-hmm. Which wasn't part of the plan at all, of course.
But adaptability.
Yeah, great flexibility.
Flexibility, you should say, not adaptability. Flexibility. You got, as you say, you ended up with a Heinz 57 of regiments and troops and tanks and just oddball stuff over.
And then we sorted ourselves out at nightfall on the night of the 14th. And as I said, by the morning of the 15th, we were back in our own squadron packets, ready for the next attack. And then there was a series of battles, and as you know, Falaise fell, and then there was the tremendous support from the Air Force shooting up the Germans as they retreated through the Falaise Gap, which is recorded.
Well, what about the great argument, now I'm sure you've heard it being a general officer and working with Americans and others, that the Canadians and the British didn't pull their weight concerning the Falaise Gap?
I think this is high-level tactics, if not strategy, and really not within my purview at that particular point in time. But there was no doubt about it that we were supposed to hold that northern hinge, and an awful lot has been written about by historians on that, to allow the Americans to sweep around to the south of us. And there is criticism of the fact that we didn't advance fast enough or far enough, but as I say, that's high-level strategy that...
No, I realize it's high-level strategy. What I guess I'm getting at, was there any comments or criticism that you heard at the time?
No, I can't recall. You see, as I told you, I don't think on tape that in battle, 500 to 1,000 yards of territory to your immediate front is all that you're really worried about. And if you had objectives given to you in that particular territory, then your job was to seize them with the greatest inflict of casualty on the enemy and the least on yourself.
Oh,
this was the name of the game.
No, I'm just thinking, well, I'm sure you've heard this before, that the Americans felt that it was, the Canadian-British fault, and the Canadians and the British felt the Americans had nothing to, well, didn't know what they're talking about. They should have been, they themselves had the open ground, they should have been firing along quicker.
I've heard this controversy, and when I was director of armor and later when I was director of combat development, I used to discuss it with Americans who had been in that particular battle, or at least to the south of us at that time. And they were people who later became general officers, but even as I, were captains and majors at the time, and they had their share of schmozzles too, let me tell you. I remember when Terry Allen's division was put in the our immediate right flank to clear the road between Breda and Tilburg later on in the Northwest European battle, and Terry Allen's Timberwolves were thrown in as the division that had not been in action in that area before, and they were gung-ho. I went to their old group because I was the right-hand squadron by this time. I'd become a major and they were, I formed the junction points between our division and Terry Allen's division. And boy, they were gung-ho that particular night, and nothing this side of hell will stop the Timberwolves, you know, this kind of gung-ho spirit. But they took as bad a bloody nose in that particular battle as we took the first day we were in action. There's nothing like experience. And it's amazing, the tank commanders who survived the first three or four major battles, nearly all of them survived to the end of the war. Because you learned by the experience of fire. And there's an old expression, nobody can describe the fire unless you felt the heat of the flame. And that applies in war. It really does.
Well, General Tedley, I think we've come pretty far today. I think we should pull the plug. Next day, if I can see again, we'll continue with the Falaise and right through to the end of the war, if that's possible, sir.
Fine. I think we'd better target on some major engagements.
Engagements, and yeah, well, that's what I thought. Yeah. I thought we would...
Because memory is not that good on the minor skirmishes that go on.
No, it's just that we've got you to France now.
Yeah.
And we can pick up from August.
Perfect. Whatever you say.
August 44 to the end of the war. Thank you very much, sir.